Hello, and welcome to Bible Talk Radio. I'm your host, Zai Mazza, and today's episode is called The Oldest Story Ever Told. This is part one of a series on Babylonian mythology, because, as I mentioned last time, the time that the Bible was written was a period of time known as the Babylonian Exile. And during this time, the Jewish people were very heavily influenced by the beliefs and the culture of Babylon at the time. This is evident from the stories and the myths from the time of Babylon, and a lot of those myths date back to Sumeria. For those of you that don't know, Sumeria is the cradle of civilization. It's where the first written language was invented, cuneiform. And the story I'm about to tell you today is quite literally the oldest story ever told. And I'm sure there are stories that were told before this story, but that's the oldest story that's written down that we have record of that's ever been told. And the name of that story is the Epic of Gilgamesh. Gilgamesh was a king in Sumeria in a city called Uruk. It's a real city. He was a real king. They say that he's buried in the Euphrates. Of course, the legends in the Epic of Gilgamesh have been embellished. According to legend, Gilgamesh was created one-third god, two-thirds man. He was a strong king. He was brutal. He brutalized his people. Not really. Mostly what he did was he slept with all the women. He said it was his right as the king to sleep with the brides on the night of their wedding night. This is a practice that today we would call prima noctem. It was a very prevalent practice in the movie Braveheart, though the historicity of that movie is very much open to question. However, this is the earliest known record of prima noctem, is Gilgamesh taking these liberties with his people. So according to legend, his people cried out to the gods. They said, "Oh gods, Gilgamesh is sleeping with all of our women, and you should send him a companion so that he doesn't feel the need to sleep with all of our women." So the gods, you know, convened, and they sent someone down, and you'd expect a beautiful woman or something, but they sent down this feral man-beast named Enkidu, who in some depictions kind of has like antlers on his head, but that's his deal. And what he's doing is he's going around and he's thwarting all the hunters, warning the animals, getting them out of traps, leading them away. And the hunters and fur trappers are like, "Damn, what are we going to do?" And one young fur trapper, his father tells him, "Go to the king, go to Gilgamesh, he'll know what to do." And the thing about Gilgamesh is, despite being a very brutal king, is he's very wise. He knows what's up. So this hunter, fur trapper's son, he goes to Gilgamesh and he's like, "Hey, Gilgi," or King Gilgi, if you prefer. He says, there's this guy and he's ruining all of our hunting. We're, you know, capturing beasts and he's letting them go free and he's leading them out of the path of the arrow. What's a guy to do?" And Gilgamesh says, in his wisdom, he says, "As soon as this Enkidu figure knows the touch of a woman, the beasts will turn away from him. They'll see him as a man and no longer a beast, and they won't listen to him, and he won't be able to commune with them." And the guy's like, "Oh, okay, well, I mean, do you have any women laying around?" And Gilgamesh is like, "Well, yeah, go to the temple harlot." And here's a brief aside. In the city, In Sumerian and Babylonian times, each city kind of had a deity that they saw as inhabiting that city, as being either the protector or the main deity of that city. In ancient Rome, there was a similar practice. People would have household deities that were seen as either protecting the home or being the main deities of the home. In the city of Uruk, the main temple was dedicated to Ishtar. Ishtar, or Inanna, if you prefer. Those are her Sumerian and Akkadian / Babylonian equivalents. Ishtar is basically the Babylonian Sumerian Athena. She's the goddess of of love. I'm sorry, not Athena. She's their equivalent of like Aphrodite. She's the goddess of love, but also the queen of heaven. So she's a pretty big deal. And the temple harlot, that's not, you know, from our perspective, you hear that and you're like, yeah, the temple harlot, that's kind of a bad thing. What a lowly station. But that's kind of in ancient Rome, she would be likened more to the Vestal Virgins minus the virgin part. It was considered a high honor to be one of the temple harlots in the temple of Ishtar. Ishtar's servants were considered, you know, kind of the cream of the crop as far as servants of the gods. So this woman isn't, you know, she's not common trash by any means. So, you know, it's kind of a big ask to ask her to leave the temple and come do something. But, you know, for coming from the king, she'll do it. So, I mean, she's still a woman. So at this period of time, she's still, you know, subservient to men. But that's not to say that when this hunter treats her with any sort of disrespect, or what we would perceive as disrespect, it's because of her station as the temple harlot. That's far from true. That would be just because they were a woman and, you know, in the past people were incredibly misogynistic. But anyway, so the hunter, you know, brings the temple harlot and he's like, yo, woman, there's Enkidu over there. They don't really know his name at this point, but he's like, yo, there's this feral beast over there and you need to go seduce him. And she's like, all right, I can do that. So she goes up to Enkidu and she's like, oh, Enkidu. And she like, you know, kind of seduces him, does that whole thing where she rubs his arm / shoulder. And Enkidu is intrigued, to say the least. So yeah, he has sex with her and it's hardcore. They're in the woods. They're going at it. It's said they're going at it for 7 days before Enkidu finally exhausts himself. He's really into her, both literally and figuratively. This is like his first time with a woman, and he has all these animalistic urges because he's part beast, and he's like, he's just, he's really in there. And the epic is very graphic about that part, so I want to emphasize that. So she sleeps with him, and he returns to the beast, and they all shy away from him and run away, like, we're running away. So he basically comes back to the woman, and he's like, the beasts are running away from me. Like, what am I going to do? I don't have a place to go. And she's like, Enkidu, look at you. You're this incredibly strong dude. I bet you're stronger than Gilgamesh even. And, you know, you're pretty good looking. You could be a god among men. Just come live among men. I'll teach you. I'll civilize you. And he's like, okay, I mean, do I get to keep sleeping with you? And she's like, of course. So, you know, she brings him back to civilization. She teaches him how to drink wine. She teaches him, you know, which fork to use or whatever. And, you know, they're having sex all the while. But Enkidu gets bored. He's like, there's not really much for me to do around here. And a little while later, he hears people grumbling. They're like, man, Gilgi keeps sleeping with our women. And they're like, oh, did you hear there was that wedding a little while ago and Gilgamesh slept with the bride and she didn't even want to sleep with him and that was messed up. And Enkidu kind of gets sick of hearing about this. He's like, all right, what's going on? So he's like, look, guys, I'll solve your problem. I'm going to go to Uruk and I'm going to kick Gilgamesh's butt and I'll be your king and I'll stop doing this stuff and you guys don't even need to worry. So Enkidu kind of strolls into Uruk and people are like, damn, who's this guy? And some people are like, nah, there's no way he can take Gilgi. Gilgi is, you know, more broad, and they're like, well, yeah, but Enkidu is taller, and look at those antlers, and they're like, yeah, but Gilgamesh is, you know, he's the spirit of a warrior, he's two-thirds god, and they're like, well, he's two-thirds something, I mean, look at him, he's not human. So, you know, the townspeople are having these discussions, and then Enkidu kind of bellows out, he's like, Gilgamesh, come face me, I'm gonna kill you, and Gilgamesh, you know, comes out and he's like, what's all this ruckus about now? And he sees Enkidu and Enkidu's like, I'm gonna beat you up. And Gilgamesh is like, you're welcome to try. And the people scatter. They're like, damn, I don't want to be around when this happens. So, you know, they're brawling and they're throwing each other up against walls. Buildings are crumbling. It's kind of like the equivalent of the Superman General Zod movie where there's entirely too much destruction for this battle taking place. And you just know the cost is going to be millions of dollars to repair. But yeah, I mean, this is literally a battle of the gods. But ultimately, Gilgamesh bests Enkidu. And Enkidu's not even mad. He's like, wow, I've been bested. But what ultimately happens is they wind up becoming bros, really. He's like, whoa, you're super cool. And Enkidu's like, Gilgi, I'm going to stick by your side no matter what. But it is worth noting there's like a ton of homoerotic undertones there. In the epic prior to Enkidu coming, Gilgamesh tells his mom, he's like, you know, I had a vision that I would meet this guy and I would come to love him as a woman. And, you know, you could interpret that to mean, yeah, he's going to come to love him a lot. But, you know, at the time, biblically speaking and just culturally speaking, what else would you mean by love as a woman? Like, that's a very specific connotation. And, you know, they are described as having this, you know, relationship where Gilgamesh loves him as a woman. But I mean, they're best friends and he respects them and everything, but it's definitely implied that they had gay sex numerous times. Which is just, you know, that's the way it happens in the epic, and it's very homoerotic, and it's implied, they're never explicit about it, but the implications are hardcore. But anyway, Gilgamesh and Enkidu are living with each other, you know, Enkidu's in the palace. Evidently, his appetites have been placated by this companion the gods sent, because the people aren't complaining anymore. But Enkidu and Gilgamesh, they're getting kind of bored, especially Enkidu. So Gilgamesh proposes that they go on a bit of a quest. They want to build a new gate for the city. So Gilgamesh says, come, Enkidu, let's go to the land where the cedar wood is cut. And I guess cedar was cut someplace far away from Uruk. And let's slay Humbaba while we're out there. And Humbaba's just this fierce monster who's out there who's like, I'm Humbaba. No one can slay me. So Enkidu and Gilgamesh go and they're like, yeah, we're going to go slay Humbaba and get the wood. So they, you know, they go, they caravan up there and they start chopping down the wood. And Humbaba's like, who dares disturb my forest? And Gilgamesh and Enkidu are like, yo, like, we dare disturb your forest. And they kill Humbaba. There's like a moment of time when they were thinking of showing mercy or something, and either Gilgamesh convinced Enkidu that they shouldn't, or Enkidu convinced Gilgamesh. But either way, Humbaba's like dying, and they're like, yeah, let's just finish him off. So they straight murder him. And Ishtar is sitting up there in heaven, and she's like, wow, that's hot. Like, she's turned on by violence, I guess. But, you know, she sees Gilgamesh just totally slay this monster, and she's like, I gotta get me some of that. And, you know, bear in mind, Ishtar is the goddess of love. You know, it doesn't get much more beautiful than Ishtar. So Ishtar descends on down and she's like, you know, Gilgamesh, I could be your woman, or rather you could be my man, and we could, you know, be doing things together. And I'm literally Ishtar, so I know you're not going to say no. And Gilgamesh is like, yeah, I'm going to go ahead and pass, because there's a bunch of stories of Ishtar's lovers. Then when she grows tired of him, bad things happen to him. So that could be perceived as another instance of Gilgamesh's wisdom, but it could also be perceived as another nail in the coffin of establishing that Gilgamesh is gay. Either way, he doesn't sleep with Ishtar or marry her or anything, and Ishtar's pissed. She's never been rejected before. I mean, she's literally Ishtar, which, you know, again, that's like literally rejecting Aphrodite, or like the most beautiful woman in the world. She's dumbfounded. Gilgamesh isn't even married. So she's angry, and she goes and cries to her dad. She's like, yo, lend me the Bull of Heaven so that he'll beat up Gilgamesh. And the Bull of Heaven is this crazy beast who's actually married to her sister, Eresh-Kigal, who is the Sumerian-Babylonian equivalent of like Hades or Pluto, or, you know, the devil. She's the goddess of the underworld, and she's married to the Bull of Heaven, and her dad's like, no, like, I'm not gonna let you use the Bull of Heaven, which is weird, because they still talk about the Bull of Heaven as some sort of beast that can be borrowed. But he's like, no, I'm not gonna let you use the Bull of Heaven. And she goes, if you don't let me use the Bull of Heaven, like, I'm gonna knock down the gates of the underworld and get him myself. And he's like, fine, I mean, I raised a brat, but yeah, you can have the Bull of Heaven. And she takes the Bull of Heaven, and meanwhile, Enkidu and Gilgamesh had been transporting the cedar wood that they cut by floating it down the river back to Uruk, and they're assembling the gate, and basically Ishtar shows up, and she's like, I'm pissed that you rejected me, and she's like really demonic, and she in one bound leaps onto the walls of Uruk, which, by the way, are like Gilgamesh's crowning achievement. These walls are huge, and she just like demonically leaps on top of them, and she starts screaming. She's like, She's like a screaming banshee, and the Bull of Heaven, you know, with one hoof, he like touches the ground and like 100 people die. And then like one nostril, he flares it and another 100 people die. And the people are like, oh God, help us, we're dying. And Gilgamesh and Enkidu are like, yo, we got to put a stop to this. So they decide they're going to kill the Bull of Heaven. And they do. They wreck it. And they literally sever its head, and it's like a crazy battle. And Ishtar's like, damn, I can't believe you killed the Bull of Heaven. And she's yelling curses at them. And Enkidu has to take it too far. And he takes the Bull of Heaven's head and throws it at her. And he doesn't hit her with it. You know, it lands near her. And he's like, this is what I'd like to do to you if I could get my hands on you. He's like, he's literally trying to kill a goddess. And Ishtar's like, yo, you know, this was all in good fun. Not really. She's been angry the whole time. But now things got real. And she's like, okay, Enkidu, you can't be doing that. I'm going to strike you down. And all the gods agree. They're like, Enkidu, you can't be doing that. We're going to strike you down. And Enkidu falls ill and is stricken. And Gilgamesh is like, no. So, you know, he takes him back to the palace. And Enkidu is lying in bed like, I'm dying. And Enkidu really laments this because he always wanted to die in battle or something. And he's complaining to Gilgamesh. He's like, I'm going to die like a woman at home, and like in my bed, and this is shameful. And Gilgamesh is like, nah, I mean, it's not that shameful, man. But, you know, I'm sorry you're dying. And as Enkidu's dying, he's like, curse that temple harlot who civilized me. And it's either Enki or Enlil or Anu, one of the gods, hears his curses. And he's like, Enkidu, that's a little much to be cursing her. He also curses the you know, fur trapper too. It's like, that's a little much. I mean, it was honestly pretty good for you that you got civilized, and like, you had all these blessings, and you lived a pretty good life, and now you'll be remembered, whereas before you would have faded into obscurity. And he's like, you're right, I revoke my curses on the temple harlot and actually bestow her with blessings. But funnily enough, he at no point revokes his curses on the fur trapper or his descendants, so they're kind of screwed. But Gilgamesh is, you know, he's heartbroken. His best friend died, and now he's realizing that he himself is mortal. He's like, oh shit, I'm gonna die too. Which, he's not happy about this whatsoever. So he wants to live forever, and he knows of one guy who did it. His name was Utnapishtim. And we'll talk about him at length in the next episode when we talk about the Atrahasis, another Babylonian story that was either adapted from the Epic of Gilgamesh or the Epic of Gilgamesh adapted. But the thing you need to know is Utnapishtim is really Noah, the biblical Noah. Except in Babylon and Sumeria, after the deluge, Utnapishtim was granted immortality, as well as, you know, his seed would propagate the earth. And the story of how he came to get that is, once again, we'll talk about that later. But Gilgamesh is like, I gotta go talk to him and figure out the secret of immortality. So he goes to Utnapishtim, or he decides he's going to go to Utnapishtim. So he goes to the land of Utnapishtim, and there are these, like, massive stone giants. And he's like, I gotta kill these massive stone giants. So he just, they're like golems, I guess you would call them, or think of them as. So he just straight murders them. And he's like, he runs into all these people along the way before then, because he's been traveling so long. He travels up this, like crazy tube or tunnel to the land, like across where he like outruns the sun or something to get to the area of Utnapishtim. And, you know, he sees these golems, like I said, and kills them. And then he runs into Ur-Shanabi, who I guess is the Sumerian equivalent of Charon. He's the ferryman to lead them across. And Ur-Shanabi's like, yo, you shouldn't have killed those guys. And Gilgamesh is like, why? They were scary and big. And they're like, rawr. And Ur-Shanabi's like, yeah, but the thing about this river to take you to Utnapishtim is it's like, it'll dissolve you or like kill anyone that steps into it. Only those golem guys can push the ferry across. And Gilgamesh is like, shit, I shouldn't have done that. And Ur-Shanabi's like, it's okay, just go ahead and, you know, go cut that wood over there and, you know, cut down 120 of them and fashion them into oars. And Gilgamesh is like, all right. And he does the whole thing without sleeping. He's like, chop, 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 chop. And he's just getting more and more tired and haggard looking. And he finally chops him down. And Urshanabi's like, cool, so I can take you across. And what happens is Urshanabi will put one of these oars into the water to ferry him across. And it dissolves. And, you know, that, and he's able to do it to get one good oar out of it, one good scoop of the water. And he uses up all of the oars on the journey to Utnapishtim. And they get to Utnapishtim, and I guess Gilgamesh's reputation had preceded him, because Utnapishtim's like, Urshanabi, why did you bring this guy to me? Like, who's this rando? And Urshanabi's like, oh, this is Gilgamesh. And Utnapishtim's like, Gilgamesh, why do you look so tired and haggard and, you know, horrible? And Gilgamesh is like, I've been traveling, all right? Like, he's been getting this a lot. It's kind of like when someone keeps asking you, like, oh, are you okay? Are you okay? There's that psychological experiment where they hired a receptionist and kept asking her if she was okay or if she was feeling sick. And she eventually, even though she was feeling fine at the beginning of the day, she, like, went home sick. So people keep asking him if he's tired, and it's a little bit of foreshadowing. And he's like, no, Utnapishtim, I'm fine. But listen, I want to live forever. And at this time, Utnapishtim wants to lay a little knowledge on his wife. And he's like, yo, wife, watch how horrible the rest of human beings are. He's going to lie to us. And he goes, okay, Gilgamesh, you can have immortality if you can stay awake for 7 days. And bear in mind, Gilgamesh has been traveling and he's been awake for a while, and people keep telling him how tired he is. And no sooner does Utnapishtim say this, does Gilgamesh fall into a deep sleep. And to illustrate to Gilgamesh how long he sleeps, Utnapishtim tells his wife to bake one loaf of bread for every day he's been asleep. And he sleeps for, like, the full 7 days. And Gilgamesh wakes up and he's like, what? I didn't sleep a week. And Utnapishtim's like, yeah, you did, buddy. Here, look at these loaves of bread. And, like, some of them are molding and some of them are a little bit stale. But the point is there's seven of them that are all in different stages of decay. And Utnapishtim really just did this to prove a point. He's saying, like, oh, you're trying to overcome death, but look at you. You can't even overcome sleep. And Gilgamesh is pretty sad about this. And Utnapishtim kind of feels bad and, you know, lets him take a bath. And, or has his ferryman give Gilgamesh a bath. Then his wife is kind of like, you know, it's a little bit rude to let, you know, he came all this way, we should at least give him a gift. And Utnapishtim goes, okay, fine. So he tells Gilgamesh that at the bottom of the ocean, there is a plant that can grant immortality, and he describes the plant. It can't really grant immortality, but it'll make him young again. So Gilgamesh is like, cool, I'm all for it. So he ties stones to his feet, and he travels there with Urshanabi, they're BFFs now, and he walks to the bottom of the sea, and he gets the plant, and he's like, Urshanabi, I got the plant! You know what I'm gonna do? I'm gonna bring this to all the old people in Uruk so they can eat it, and then I'll eat it. And, you know, that was his first mistake. He should have just eaten the plant then and there. But he wants to bring it back. So he, you know, stops for the day at a spring, and he's, like, bathing himself, and he falls asleep or something. And, or, like, you know, he's just bathing himself kind of out of sight of the fruit. And he turns around and he sees this snake come and eat the fruit. And he's like, no, curse you, snake. And once again, I just want to point out the parallel between the serpent being responsible for the loss of eternal life in this story and the biblical stories. But that's a whole nother matter. Point is, he sees the serpent shed his skin and he's like, oh, man, I guess, you know, it's over. Why he can't find more of the fruit at the bottom of the ocean, I don't know. But he just gives up. He's like, I understand now, he says. Life is not for me to live forever. Instead, life is, the point is to be remembered. I can be immortal in that way. And he goes and he inscribes it all on a stone that he puts at the bottom of the gate, like at the base stone in his city, Uruk. And that is the story of the Epic of Gilgamesh, the oldest story ever told, whose influence on the Bible cannot be overstated. Part of the story has been abbreviated, namely the story of Utnapishtim and the deluge. Make sure to stay tuned next time for part two of this miniseries, where we'll talk about that. And in part three, we will discuss the Babylonian creation story, as well as the descent of Inanna. And that will conclude all of the background we should need to know to understand most of the Babylonian influences in the Bible. Thanks for listening and have a great day.